catch George Norrie's internet TV show, Beyond Belief, for dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained. The upcoming episode is Face to Face with the Paranormal, featuring Susan Massino. You can sign up for 10 days free right now at beyondbelief.com and enjoy hours and hours of fascinating past shows. That's beyondbelief.com. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. More with Mike Barra when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. I'd like to give a quick shout out to all the fader knots out there and the listeners to my program, Fade to Black. And welcome over here to Coast, expanding that Coast to Coast family. And you know what? It kind of goes both ways. So hello to all you fader knots. And Mike, you've been enjoying the fader knot family for quite a while. It's a pretty extraordinary experience. And they're welcoming you to Coast AM tonight. Welcome back.
Well, thanks a lot. Yeah, it's been a blast getting to know your audience, Jim.
They've gotten to know you, believe me. You know, Mike, one of the things that you and I have talked about a lot, not only on my program, but you've talked about it on Coast to Coast and shows past, and really over the last year, there's been this phenomena with the internet and photographs from Mars.
Yeah.
What is going on?
Well, what's going on is, you know, we have two working rovers on the planet, and they keep taking pictures, and the whole place is just littered with equipment, with junk, with, you know, ruins, big ruins, pyramids, small stuff, mechanical debris, mechanical devices, pistons, you know, jet engine casings. I mean, just all air conditioners. I mean, you name it, it's up there. Gears, it's up there. And what you've got is you've got a ton of people on the internet now that are getting really good at finding this stuff. And as they just go and they scour through the, especially the curiosity images, and, you know, that thing landed in what looks like the middle of a junkyard. There's just an incredible number of things they're finding. They're also finding stuff like, you know, rocks with moss on them and that sort of thing, which are just really, really hard to come by if the planet Mars is really what NASA tells us it is, which is this ice cold, completely desiccated hell. And it doesn't look that way when you look at the stuff that's left there.
Well, what is the problem here? Is NASA just getting lazy and not, you know, photoshopping and altering these photographs in time? Or is it that maybe their intention, you know, leaking this out to us so we do find it?
Yeah, I think that's part of the issue. And that's one of the things I'm going to address in the Secret Society's book, which we partially addressed in Dark Mission, Richard and I, is that, you know, I think that there's some sort of almost religious requirement that they put the information out there. Maybe not perfect, maybe not crystal clear, maybe not the smoking gun, and certainly with no official acknowledgement. But the bottom line is they put the stuff out there because I think that they believe, that NASA believes, that they are going to be held accountable at some point for their actions and for whether or not they told us the truth. They're going to say, well, look, you know, here's a picture of this stuff everywhere. There's pictures there. There's pictures there. We put it out. It's not our fault that they didn't recognize what they were looking at. So I think that's part of the game that goes on. And the other thing, too, Jimmy, is that, the pictures are not that good. They pretty much suck. I mean, if you look at the Pathfinder photographs of the near Pathfinder landing site from 1997, and then you look at the Viking stuff from 1976, the only conclusion you can come to is that in the, you know, intervening 20 years, camera technology on the planet Earth declined by, you know, about 70%, because it's just horrific. And these rover photographs are really not all that much better. I mean, you know, you look at anything from any kind of distance, they're these very heavily JPEG, heavily artifacted images, and it's sometimes that, you know, something looks great when you look at it in the full screen, and then you zoom it up, and it just becomes so distorted with artifacts that you realize there's not really a lot you can do. Now, some people seem to be better at bringing out the detail than I am. You know, I've been accused of being an expert at Photoshop, which I'm certainly not, but you know, the bottom line is the picture should look a lot better than they do.
What do you make of the solar flare explanations that have been put out there lately, and also the bad pixel?
Oh, the solar flare explanations, you mean in terms of the bright objects that have been appearing on the pictures? Or
yes, yes, the lights in the distance, lights in the sky.
Well, you know, it's just fascinating to me that this stuff didn't happen at first. It didn't seem to ever happen with the other two rovers, with Spirit and Opportunity, but suddenly Curiosity has this
problem.
Problem, you know, this disease where it has all these burnt out pixels. And, some of them do look like burnt out pixels, but others look like solid metallic objects that are simply reflecting light in a way that they should not. It's a specular reflection. And, you know, that's just not really a viable explanation. And the thing about that, it's kind of like when you put an explanation like that out, guess what? It allows you to write off virtually everything. It allows you to say, well, that's just a burned out pixel. And, you know, so no matter what somebody might find on an image, it's just the quote unquote burned out pixel. So what's the proof that the pixels are burned out? If there are actually problems with the imager, wouldn't they tend to cluster around the same area of a frame? You know, in other words,
a consistent bad pixel in every single image in that same spot.
That is what I would expect if it was something physical. But they're saying, oh, it's just a cosmic ray that happens to catch, you know, the mirrors happens to catch the light gathering instruments at just the right time. And that just seems kind of unlikely because, again, as you go back and look at the Viking and you look at the Pathfinder and you look at Spirit and Opportunity, that just didn't seem to happen. But now it apparently does on a regular basis on Curiosity.
Similar to the swamp gas explanation of the 60s.
Yeah, you could say that. You know, you could say that. But the thing is, again, I think I want to focus less on that kind of stuff and more on, you know, the things that we can actually see. And we really are seeing incredible stuff on some of these images. And kudos to all the people out there. There's some great groups on Facebook. I think the Mars Reality is one, and there's a few others. Go look them up on Facebook, and there's people posting really, really great stuff. Now, there's also people posting images of things that I look at and I say, oh, that's JPEG artifacts or that's just a rock. But I mean, every day there's something new, and literally you could do a monthly update and probably have 25 blatantly artificial objects like that. Howitzer cannon thing, you know, I don't think that's what it is. I think it's smaller than that, but that howitzer cannon thing that we were talking about last summer. I mean, that's just incredible, and it's obviously artificial.
It looks howitzer-ish.
Yeah.
Certainly does.
Yeah, or some sort of you know, probe or metal tube or something sticking up out of. Well, but it, I mean, from the position, it looks like a howitzer, isn't it? It looks like a tank with a gun on it.
It certainly does. What I can't tell in that picture is the actual physical size of it. Is it something that's 30 or 40 or 50 feet long and 20 or 30 feet high, or is it 1 inch by 1 inch?
But judging from the position of the camera, knowing the size of the rover, I would say it's something. I would say that metal tube, and of course, isn't this great radio, folks? We're sitting here talking about pictures that we haven't posted on the website, but they're out there. But I think you could walk up to that howitzer cannon thing and grab that stick, that protrusion, that probe that's sticking out. I think that's probably about the size of the handle of a croquet mallet. So imagine that kind of size and density. You could probably pick that thing up by that and walk around with it on Mars if you were there.
Well, I did my best to explain that picture away as something natural, some anomaly that was natural on Mars, and you just can't do it. Your brain won't allow that.
Not if you have intellectual integrity, you can't do it.
Well, okay, or not. It still just doesn't look, it just doesn't look right. I can't think of anything in nature that would, you know, and there's nothing similar to it anywhere in that photograph.
Yeah, there are some other unusual things in that photograph, but that is the one that sticks out. And you just look at that and go, yeah, that's not a rock. I don't know what that is, but it looks mechanical. And it's not a rock, and it's on Mars.
Yeah, it just seems that the last year it is just flooded, and I don't know if the if the internet has more people interested in the subject, or quite simply that curiosity is in a spot where there are some strange objects there that are not natural.
It's both. It's really both. It's the fact that they landed in Gale Crater, and there is just a lot of stuff in there. And, you know, I think that was an area that used to be inhabited for some reason. You know, they do say that they think the crater was filled with water once. And, of course, NASA says billions of years ago, but it could just as easily have been just thousands of years ago. So, you know, it's definitely an intriguing place on Mars. There's a lot of stuff there, and there are a veritable army of people out there looking at this stuff now and doing a great, great job of finding things.
You want to take some calls at the bottom of the hour? Let's get this warmed up.
Sounds great.
Okay. And then before we get to that, I just want to let everybody know, let's open up the phone lines. Now, you were talking earlier about the Illuminati.
Yeah.
And one of the things, and I want you to comment on this, one of the things that I had heard when I was very, very young is a theory about the Illuminati that I haven't really heard much about since, except for the way that you have spoken about it. And this is the reference, that the Illuminati isn't from 1776. The very foundations of the Illuminati are from the very foundations of ancient man, tribal man, ancient man. And that's those families and tribes, the stronger ones were able to dominate the earth, you know, millennia ago. That's the true origins of the Illuminati. And that's where you're going in this book. Where did you get, develop this idea?
Well, I mean, that's always been suspected, and what I've suspected was when Richard and I found out and really figured out that NASA had this bizarre fascination with the gods of ancient Egypt, specifically Isis, Osiris, Horus, and Set. When we found that out, the question became, well, why? Well, it turns out that the Freemasons are kind of obsessed with the story of Isis and Osiris and Horus and Set. So when you look at the fact that there's all these Freemasons in NASA and the Freemasons have this fascination with the ancient gods of Egypt and there's all this Egyptian mythology and symbolism and stuff in NASA, then you kind of begin to put together there must be some connection here. And as, you know, as I go back, what I'm now connecting through is that in the story, the Sumerian creation stories, basically it says that, you know, some of these kids, some of these guys that were given kingdoms in Egypt. And then eventually, after the flood, there was this horrible war in Samaria, and Sumer was basically wiped out. And so everybody that was left went to Egypt and went to the dynastic Egypt, the civilization that was established there. And that was when the priesthood, it even kind of says this, that there was a special priesthood set up where the gods would train these special people, these special humans, to learn all of their secrets and keep those secrets through time and guide the human race. And so that's where the secret societies got started. Now, the Illuminati, in terms of the specifics, they're not really a big thing of mine. I can believe that they exist. Certainly the Roman Catholic Church believes that they exist. But I haven't really found a whole lot of evidence that, to my mind, that the Illuminati actually exist. However, I can look at the Freemasons and I can say clearly that they exist and clearly that they trace their ancestry all the way back through the Knights Templar, you know, into ancient Egypt. And so you've got this string, this line that basically now goes from these high gods who came to Earth for whatever reason, established bases here, created the physical bodies that we now, you know, are using, a human race, and we're not a slave race, interacted with us, interbred with us, and that out of those bloodlines came these secret societies. So, you know, that's, to me, it's a very logical progression, and I now feel like I've got all the linking pieces in place to say this is how it was put together. And this is how they ended up in NASA. And then the question becomes, what did NASA do with that information, and why were these secret societies so powerful within NASA?
And isn't it strange that I think nearly every astronaut, certainly that walked on the moon and flew around the moon, was a Freemason?
Well, yeah, I mean, six of the 12 that walked on the moon were Scottish Rite Freemasons, and that's a very specific subset of Masonry. It's not, you know, again, anybody could be a Freemason. You could walk in, you know, you pay your tribute, you become an enter the pratica, you become a master Mason, you go through the three steps, but the Scottish Rite is a very specific subdivision of that, and all these guys were Scottish Rite Freemasons, and that's where the 33rd degree guys come into it. They're the ones that have the 33 degrees, and they're the ones that control everything. And, you know, then you have Buzz Aldrin even performing a Masonic ceremony in the lunar module before he and Neil Armstrong go out onto the surface of the moon for the first time and set foot on the moon. And it's like, you know, if I came to you and said, well, they were all Mormons, and they all went to this particular Mormon temple in Washington, D.C., and the first one that was there on the moon actually performed a specific Mormon ceremony on the moon in the lunar module before they walked on the moon, people would go, oh, that's really weird, and why did they do that, and those dang Mormons. But when you say the Freemasons, everybody goes, oh, I don't want to know about that.
You can identify it to any group. Yeah. Boy Scouts, you know, everyone was a Boy Scout.
Right.
You know, you would find that strange. But with the and I'm not making light of it, I'm just saying that's the way we look at things. Now, when you have potential secrets that need to be kept, such as possible objects on the moon, maybe, you know, an ET craft sitting on the horizon observing.
Yep.
Having Freemasons there would be the perfect group to keep a secret.
Well, it would, and it would also be the perfect way to find out if somebody could keep a secret. In other words, well, you know, Buzz, if you're going to go to the moon, you've got to become a Freemason. You know, probably that's not the case with Buzz, but let's say Edgar Mitchell. You've got to become a Freemason. So he goes and he does it, and then you can watch him and see if he reveals any of the secrets of the order. And if he doesn't, then after a year or two, you know, you can trust him, and then he becomes one of the guys that you can send to the moon. So, you know, I'm pretty sure that this is correct, that there is not a single mission to the moon that did not include at least one Freemason. And the truth is also, Jimmy, that, you know, guys don't have to reveal that they're Freemasons. They can claim that they're not. I mean, Neil Armstrong, as far as I know, was not, but I have been told that his father was a Freemason.
That's right.
So, you know, so it's like, okay, maybe Neil wasn't, but Buzz was. Well, then why did Neil get to go out first? And the reason Neil went to go out first is because they only had one camera, and his job was to photograph the first Freemason on the surface of the moon. It was Buzz Aldrin. That's why all the pictures from Apollo 11 are of Buzz Aldrin, not Neil Armstrong.
Before we head to the break at the bottom of the hour, and we will be taking phone calls when we come back after the break, what is your favorite when you want to present some evidence? You're F. Lee Bailey. You're in court, and you need to show the one definitive object on the moon, and you've got photographic proof to back it up. What is it that you're going to present?
On the moon?
Yes.
I'm going to give you the head of the robot, Data's head, in Shorty Crater on Apollo 17. That's what I'm going to give you, because that thing does not belong there. It is metallic. It has a painted red stripe on the upper lip. It looks like the head of a robot. There is all kinds of other mechanical junk around it. And it makes me wonder if there wasn't some sort of conflict or battle that took place on the moon. And maybe one of the earlier versions of our society, maybe one of the earlier versions of humanity, actually created machines and went to war with them, like something out of Battlestar Galactica. That's the thing that I'm going to show you and say, okay, look at this. This is not a rock. This is why it's not a rock. These are all mechanical things. And then you move over here and there's the head of something. And it can't be biological because it wouldn't be able to survive in the lunar environment. So it must be mechanical. That's the thing I'm going to show you.
We'll be taking your calls right after this. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We are speaking with Mike Barra. Ancient aliens on Mars, objects on Mars, ancient aliens on the moon. All of those things that I love to talk about. And we'll be finishing it up, taking your calls when we come back. Stay with us, Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back. This is Coast to Coast AM, and listening to Three Dog Night reminds me right now, actually, the place to be will be this weekend, February 6th through the 8th, where you can come out and hang out with George, Mike Barra, and myself at the Conscious Life Expo right here in Los Angeles at the LAX Airport at the Hilton. More info at coasttocoastam.com, georgenori.com, my website, and consciouslifeexpo.com. Come check out George and his science form. Saturday, February 7th, I'll be there. And I'll be back more with Mike Barra and taking your calls right after this. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We are talking with Mike Barra. And, hey, Mike, I mentioned before the break the Conscious Life Expo and George's presentation that he's going to be doing. What are you going to speak about at Conscious Life?
Well, I'm going to do the Ancient Aliens panel is on Friday night at 8 o'clock. So if you guys are in L.A., you can get down for that. It's going to be great. You're going to be there, I think, right?
Yeah, you know I am.
We're going to be in the bar afterwards. It's from 8 to 10, and Jason Martell is going to be there. I think Jason's got a he's got a workshop actually before that, so he's on early Friday. And then after the Ancient Aliens panel on Friday night, any excessive drinking, I have to get up really early in the morning, like 10 a.m., to do my workshop at the Conscious Life Expo there in L.A. And it's going to be basically I'm going to be showing you tons of pictures from the moon and Mars. And I'm going to give you a sneak preview of Ancient Aliens and Secret Societies. So they'll be doing that. And then I have a book signing right after that. And the rest of the time, I'm just going to be wait to be drafted for different things. I usually get drafted for a panel here and there. And so it's going to be a really great weekend. I'm going to be attending all of George's stuff with you. And it's just going to be hanging out with some of my best buddies, you and the master, George Norrie. We're all just going to have a great time. Tom Danheiser, all those people.
Yeah, it's going to be great because, the name says itself, what it's about, the conscious life. But it's a bunch of like-minded, not only presenters and speakers, but everybody in the audience. And it's just a really open-minded gathering of very powerful thought. And it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. There's a ton of great people there. You know, go to the websites and look. And they're doing live streaming for the first time.
Yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to be great.
You can do that. So it is going to be great. And you know, it's pretty much the biggest UFO-type conference in the universe. I mean, thousands of people go through there. So it's just going to be great.
It's going to be a good time. Looking forward to seeing you in a couple of days. Let's go to the wild card line. Rosemary in Ontario, Canada. Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call, Jimmy and Mike. In the book of Revelations, it's mentioned that the third angel, when he blows his trumpet, he's mentioned a great star fell from heaven, and the name of the star is Wormwood. Is that any relation to Planet X?
It could be. And the thing is, what I don't know about Revelations is I don't know if it's the future or it's the past. The way I read it, it seems to me like it's really recounting stuff that happened before. And the star that falls from the sky could be Nibiru. It could also be, a comet or an asteroid that is disrupted by a close approach of Nibiru to the asteroid belt and then hits the Earth. That's another possibility for that's something that could have caused a great flood. But, it may be both the future and the past, because if what the Anunnaki believed is true, that there is destiny and destiny's repeated cycles, then it may be something we have to go through again in the future. So, I don't know. At this point, I think that's a perfectly viable hypothesis, but I don't think I can prove that one.
Thank you, Rosemary. Let's go to wild card Amber in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome, Amber, to Coast AM.
Good morning, Jimmy and Mike. How are you?
We're doing great, Amber. What have you got for Michael?
Okay, this is going to sound a little crazy, but this is something that has been bugging me for months. Okay, what is the connection between the reptilians and the Anunnaki?
Well, I am not an expert in the reptilians. I don't know that there is a connection. What I can tell you is that there are a lot of people who have these strange experiences. Now, I've worked on some other shows besides Ancient Aliens. I worked on the show Uncovering Aliens, where we looked at abduction cases. And we did go talk to several families, and some of those episodes were just recently repeated here on, I guess, American Heroes or something network yesterday. Anyway, we looked at a lot of cases, and we talked to a lot of abductees, and we didn't run across any reptilian cases. So, you know, again, to me, I don't know that I can make a connection between the Anunnaki and the reptilians, at least at this point. What is interesting is that at the end of some of the Sumerian documents, some of the tablets, it talks about how Enki does not leave the earth, but he goes to the land over the sea, which is the Americas. And what's very curious about those civilizations, the Maya, the Aztecs, the very, very early Incas and things, is that there's a lot of serpent worship there. So it may be something that, that he brought with him. But by all, you know, by all accounts, Enki and the Anunnaki were human. They were humanoid. They were like us. And I don't think they were very different from us really at all. So I don't know that I can make a connection.
Thank you, Amber, for the call. Let's go west of the Rockies, Paul, in Seattle, Washington. Rocking Welcome on. To the program, Paul.
Hey, well, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. Quickly, okay, in the book of Old Testament, Obadiah, I listened to Dr. Frank Strange's talk about where it says, I can't quote the scripture, but it says, you will make your nest in the stars, and I will take you down, you know, like they got too haughty, and so he, God knocked him back down. Second of all, what is the connection? I saw on Ancient Aliens that the Rothschilds, he claims he was a descendant of the Anunnaki, and I'll take my answer. Hey, you guys have a great night tonight. Go Seahawks!
Hey, Paul, well, there you go. I was going to say, do you have a prediction for the game, for the Super Bowl? All right, go ahead, Mike.
Well, I mean, if you go through the tablets and actually read them, you know, Enlil, who was kind of the bad guy in all this, of the two brothers, Enki and Enlil, he was the one who was questioning the morality of this whole concept of creating humanity the whole way. I mean, he was basically saying, you know, I'm not sure this is a good idea. It's really God's job to make life. It's not our job to make life. And the counter argument is we're not making life. We're just modifying existing life and putting it together to create these guys. And, you know, he's the one who's always saying, I just don't think that there's necessarily going to be any good that's going to come of this. And as one sort of affront to their moral standards after another happens during the time that they're on Earth, including, you know, it reaches the point where we create man, then we give them the ability to procreate, which really makes Enlil angry. And that's when he ejects Tiamat and the Adamu from Eden. It's actually called the Eden. It's the garden, the wonderful, lush place where they've been living. That's the reason why. He's like, okay, now you've made them able to reproduce. And the argument is, well, we had to make them able to reproduce so we could create more of them because the process was too slow. And then, you know, his brother Enki actually interacts with human females, has children of his own who are incredibly bright. He's like, okay, now they have our intelligence. So when is this going to stop? He's the guy all along who's saying, this is not a good idea because basically these guys could be our equals. And the one thing that they do not give us is long life. There's apparently some bread and some elixirs from Nibiru that had we drank from those, we would have the same long life of thousands and thousands of years that they have. But that's the one thing that's denied us. But it's and then he's the one who finally says, when the deluge is coming, let's just be rid of the whole thing. Let's let the humans perish. And everybody here has to agree to that. And that's kind of what goes down. So when you look at the biblical, the Old Testament thing of where you have a God who creates man in his own image, loves man, but then becomes distressed by man's wickedness and wipes him out with a flood, what really happens is that man is created, at least our physical bodies are created, by the Anunnaki. The whole thing goes haywire. It's not our wickedness. It's nothing that human beings do that is wrong. It's just that he, Enlil, gets so angry that so many Anunnaki laws have been broken that he wants to just wipe the whole slate clean and not have humans anymore. He thinks that's the best way to deal with the problem. And he's really got a valid viewpoint from their perspective. You know, he really does.
Thank you for that call, Paul. Now let's go to Wild Card Dennis, Orange County, California. Dennis, welcome to Coast AM. Dennis, 3, 2, 1, Wild Card. We're going to go to Paul in Minnesota. Paul, welcome to Coast AM.
Hey, this is Lily Paul. Good evening, gentlemen. Just had a quick question for the guests, and was thinking about the Masons in their interest in mathematics, like with the Pythagoras, and thinking about the mathematics that's involved with ancient structures and whatnot, and how the guests felt about that. Like, I feel like mathematics is almost kind of like a universal language, and if you're going to lose some knowledge and you thought your civilization was going to go under, that would be the best way to put that out there.
Thank you for the call, Paul. That is a great question. Mike, I think that constantly comes up when all of us rational, inquisitive thinkers are looking at this. Where does the math come from? And it seems to, certainly with ancient structures like Giza and going back to even Göbekli Tepe, that these Pythagoras, all of this knowledge seemed to come up pretty quick when it comes to mathematics.
Well, yeah, that's the great dichotomy of ancient human history, which is that we start out really, really smart, and then we get dumb, and then we start to get smart again. And that just doesn't make any sense. You don't start out smart unless somebody superior to you is teaching you how to do all these things and teaching you about mathematics and geometry and how to build pyramids and how to build enormous megalithic structures like Göbekli Tepe and the Osirian in Egypt and things like that. So, you know, I think that the idea of math being the universal language is truth, and there's, like, we don't know where this knowledge came from. We really don't. Nobody knows why a circle is 360 degrees. Now, I suspect it's because the orbit of the Earth used to be 360 days. And in fact, there's stuff in the Sumerian cuneiform tablets that talks about how Enki and his son Marduk went to the moon and spent a couple of months there and recorded all this stuff and basically said, oh, okay, the Earth has a year of 360 days. And then I think something happened. The Earth got struck by a comet or an asteroid and got pushed a little bit out of its orbit. And now we have 365 and a quarter days. I think that messed our orbit up. So, you know, again, the big mystery is, where did all this stuff come from? Well, if it didn't come from extraterrestrials, I really don't have a clue, because it seems to go back all the way to ancient recorded history. And Jim Mars, by the way, who's going to be with us at the expo, he likes to point out that nobody knows where beer came from. So they may have also given us the gift of beer, which I think we should all, you know, be really grateful for.
And, you know, thanks to Jim Mars, we wouldn't have known that. Let's go to Wildcard Line, Ross in Concord, California. Ross, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Hello. I'm going to ask the Luciferian question of that. How can we overturn destiny that the creator or whoever has set up so that we do not repeat the same mistakes of the Anunnaki, and so that we can instead rise into our view of dominance? And what was so wrong with the Anunnaki interbreeding with human women?
Thank you so much, Ross.
What was wrong with it was that it was generally regarded as forbidden. Now, it's not a situation where they already had a pre-existing law of, you know, if you create a beautiful female, you can't mate with it on another planet. They didn't have any laws like that because they'd never been to another planet before they came to Earth, and they'd never faced this. But there was an order at one point given by Anu, the king, or to Enlil, the Yahweh Elohim, and there's all these different names that Enlil is known by, that, you know, this probably isn't a good idea and it should stop. But on the other hand, you had all these guys, all these Anunnaki here who needed wives. And, you know, so you had, why was it a problem? I think only in Enlil's mind was there a moral issue with it. It doesn't seem like anybody else really had a problem with it. And what was the first part of the question?
It had to do with what we had to do to change, to not make the same mistakes as the Anunnaki did.
Well, to recognize that there are two cycles. There is fate and destiny, and that which is destined is not necessarily fated. And I think that that's what I think the altruistic purpose of the secret societies is. It's to teach us how to not make the same mistakes that they made and the ruin that they brought to this world. They came here with the best intentions. They wanted to save their planet. They never intended, when they created us, for us to, you know, suffer or be miserable or be unhappy or have bad lives or have wars or throw nuclear bombs at each other. So I think that really, it's bringing this story out and recognizing the story and recognizing the tragedy of how it ended up is the one way that we can break the cycle of fate, at least. We can't break the cycle of destiny, but we can break the cycle of fate.
Well, as we wind down, I have to ask you one question, and this is between friends. You know, you've been certainly been
two friends just listening on that.
Yeah, it's just you and I sitting in my living room, right? Yeah,
right, exactly.
Is you know, Mike, you've been rolling that rock uphill in a lot of, for a long time, for 20 years. And what do you do to fight the wave that is going against you, and not only the skeptics, but the ones that just want to combat you at every step of the way, because, you know, you choose, and like I said at the intro, you're steadfast in your research and your belief, and you don't waver. How do you keep up the good fight?
Well, you know, for me, it's that I know that we are all right about all this stuff. I mean, there may be certain issues that we're wrong about. There may be, you know, maybe some of the 9/11 stuff really isn't all that serious, not to bring up a sore subject, but, you know, there's going to be parts of what we believe in as a unit, as whether you call them fate or not, or the Coast to Coast AM audience, or just anybody who's interested in these kinds of TV shows and programs. We are going to, maybe there's parts of the story that we've got wrong, but the vast majority of it, 80% of it, we've got it right. And it's the truth. And knowing that it's the truth keeps pushing me forward. And again, I don't care about convincing those other guys. I've gotten to the point now where I've completely blocked out the people that attack me. I responded for a long time. It takes a lot of energy. I basically set up a page where I said, if you believe what these people say, here's my counter argument to a dozen of them or so. And that's it. I'm just going to let that stand. And now I only want to talk to the people that are actually interested in listening, and knowing that there are people out there that want to listen, knowing that there are people out there that are going to make their own discoveries because they'll be inspired by me or you or George Norrie or listening to these programs or some of the other guests you have on. Just that's what fuels me. That's what gets me up every day saying, you know, hey, we need to move forward with this. And the other thing that's really important, I think, that fires me up is we are not the weird ones. They are. The people that look at us like we're black sheep, like we're crazy because we believe this weird stuff, they're the ones who aren't awake. They're the ones who aren't paying attention. They're the ones that are living with their heads in the sand. So I really feel like I'm on a quest to make people feel comfortable with who they are and with their fascination with this whole realm of stuff that's out there, all these different issues that we talk about on shows like this.
When does the new book come out?
Well, I think it'll be out in March. I may have a little bit busier February, March than I expected, but after that settles in, I'm going to try to get it done in March, and if not, it'll be early April, so it's coming out very soon.
Now, you have a twin brother who is also an author that writes science fiction, and I don't find that to be a coincidence, by the way.
No. No.
And he's got a new book coming out on Monday, and what's the name of that book?
Yeah, and he does. It's his first novel. It's a science fiction novel called Impulse. It is in the vein of what they call military science fiction, space opera, Star Trek. If you like Star Trek, you'll love this stuff. And it's called Impulse, and actually the launch is Tuesday. He's got a thing at the University Bookstore in Seattle, a book signing, and I couldn't be prouder of him and more excited. He's worked for this his whole life, and he's achieved his dream, and I said that to him today. We just got the hard copy, the hardback. The book came out in hardback, and I held it up, and I said, you know what this is, dude? This is your dream, and it's just come true. You made it come true, and it's just, I mean, it's amazing because what it shows me is that's hard physical evidence that dreams can come true.
Thank you so much, Mike. I really enjoyed our time together tonight on Coast to Coast, and I will see you in a couple of days here in L.A. That is Mike Barra, everybody. Thank you so much. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. You can follow me at JChurch Radio on Twitter. Of course, you can listen to my program, Fade to Black, on Spreaker and iHeartRadio from 7 to 10, Monday through Friday, Pacific Coast time. And as soon as you're done with me, you just roll on in to Coast AM. I'd like to thank the Coast to Coast team here, Trish, Brian, Dan, Gina, Tom, Lisa, and, of course, George. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Everybody be safe. Have fun tomorrow with the Super Bowl. See ya.